It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network, and I'd like to tell you that we have a new and improved website. It has two new features that we think you'll love. One of them is a vastly improved search engine, so that when you type in keywords, you'll get a bunch of episodes really quick. The other is the ability to create a listener account. And in that listener account, you can save episodes for later listening. So you can create a kind of listening list. We think these features are neat and we think you'll enjoy them. Please visit the site today. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello to our listeners. I am Daran Artash, a co-host of the Middle Eastern Studies page of the New Books Network. In this episode, I am in conversation with Samuel Dolby, whose book titled Locusts of Power, Borders, Empire, and Environment in the Modern Middle East was published last year by Cambridge University Press. Hi, Sam.
Hi, Daran.
Do you mind introducing yourself?
Yeah, I'm Sam Dolby. I'm an assistant professor of history at Vanderbilt University.
Welcome. I really enjoyed reading your book, and I'm excited to talk with you about it. I also can't help but put it on record that I'm somewhat intimidated by interviewing one of the star hosts of the Ottoman History Podcast. So thank you for sitting with me. The first question I'd like to ask concerns how you came to write this book, but I'm going to ask it somewhat differently than I usually do. What came first for you, the place or the thing? So in other words, was it the Jazeera that brought you to the locusts or the locusts that brought you to the Jazeera?
It was definitely the Jazeera that brought me to the locusts. And so when I was doing dissertation research, I knew I was interested in space, and I knew I was interested in the way that people and disease and insects moved across this space. And I was especially interested in thinking about spaces that don't fit neatly with Ottoman provinces or post-Ottoman nation states. And so the Jazeera loomed for me as that region. And so the Jazeera is this region roughly between Mosul, Diyarbakir, Aleppo. Jazeera, of course, means island or peninsula in Arabic. And so it's referring to the fact that it's bounded by the Tigris and the Euphrates at the foot of the Anatolian plateau. And so the dissertation was really thinking about that space from perspectives of disease, ecology, motion of nomadic pastoralists. And locusts were a part of that, certainly, but the focus on locusts was a huge shift for the book. And so something I struggled with was figuring out how to frame all of these stories and how to figure out a structure that would hopefully make sense. And as I was doing more and more research, I kept amassing this list of all of the people who were compared to locusts. And it kept getting longer and longer and longer. And finally I said, fine, I'll make it about locusts to myself in the library, probably. And I probably disturbed someone next to me. But yeah, it took time to figure out that structure and some of the points in the dissertation, some of the points in the project as I initially envisioned it, disappeared. But that's the very short version of that transition.
So in focusing on locusts, you also don't really lose the people who are having these experiences of being moved or being mobile. Those are different things, right? And appear at different moments in the book, as well as sort of disease and the various things you mentioned that you were focusing on in the dissertation. How did you sort of come to weave these stories together, and how do you understand the relationship between these sort of human and non-human animals and the spaces that they inhabit in the Jazeera?
So first of all, I should say that part of the reason why I was able to talk about space and these insects is because the range of this particular species of locust, which is known as the Moroccan locust, it basically intersects with the Jazeera. So that's that kind of ecological dynamic is part of what helps me think about space. But part of what I'm trying to emphasize in the book and trying to emphasize in terms of environmental history of the Middle East is that there are certainly a lot of reasons to be suspicious of a kind of approach to environmental history, which uses the science of today to kind of expose the dark matter of the past. You know, no one could see these things, but now I, with 21st century science, can see it. I didn't want to take that approach. And that's not to say that I threw out science altogether. That was certainly a part of what I was doing. But what I would like to emphasize is it's actually really hard for me to read any accounts of this region without these, without people constantly talking about locusts. So there are some scientific sources and there are some, you know, scientific figures in history that are in the book, but the sources are everywhere. And so one of the ways that I decided to structure the book is around these comparisons between different groups of people and locusts. So each chapter is organized loosely around a certain kind of comparison, and these are between locusts and Arabic and Kurdish speaking nomadic pastoralists, Armenian deportees, also Assyrian refugees. These are all groups of people who end up in the Jazeera for different reasons, who move in the Jazeera in different ways, and they're all compared to locusts for not exactly the same reasons, but generally these are groups of people who are on the edges. And often it's a denigrating comparison. Of course, it's a way of talking about difference between humans. So part of my thinking there is that it's actually really hard to draw a fine line between, you know, non-human and human. And I find that when people are talking about non-human things, they're often also talking about human things.
What is one comparison that you might want to highlight for the interview?
So there are a lot. I think a few that I would briefly mention are ones by kind of famous people. So Ziya Gökalp, who's kind of one of the leading thinkers of Turkish nationalism in the early 20th century, sociologically trained. He compares the Arabic-speaking Shamar tribe to the locust. He says they come once a year, they destroy things. Yashar Kemal, this terrific novelist of modern Turkey, he compares orphans struggling after World War I to locusts. But I think one of the comparisons that struck me as the most interesting was actually by an Armenian deportee in the course of the Armenian genocide. He's on the path of deportation, and at roughly that same time, there's a locust swarm. And he sees these locusts being stepped on, and he says, that's us. We're being pushed to the edges, and we're being stepped on. And so these comparisons take on different forms. In some cases, it is, you know, very clearly a way of saying these people are backward, they destroy things. But what was striking to me about this comparison by this Armenian man was that he didn't see the locusts as a symbol of omnipotence. He actually saw them as a symbol of lack of power and saw his own fate in that.
It's hard to shift from this very real human experience, miserable human experience of seeing these animals trampled and comparing oneself to it, to one of the central themes of the book, which has to do with different attempts of the state and various local governments on dealing with locusts. And before we get to the period that the book deals with, which is mainly the late Ottoman Empire into the first decades of the 20th century, I wanted to ask you what locust management looked like in the prior decades and centuries.
So one of the things that I think is productive about thinking about locusts and thinking about history with locusts is that they're not creatures that are out there unaffected by human civilization. Like sometimes you imagine seeing the map of the range of animals, right? And that's the natural territory in which the Siberian tiger or whatever lives in. And there's a way that those maps can kind of conceal history, the way that that changes over time. Sometimes the unintended ways that human action could actually allow that range to expand. And so part of what I'm interested in with locusts is the way that Ottoman efforts to transform this region, the Jazeera, from a region primarily of animal husbandry, raising camels and sheep, into an agricultural zone. Cotton, but also wheat and barley, summer crops like sesame, fruits like watermelons. As they do that in the late 19th century, in some ways that is extending cereal bounty to the locusts. Now, your question was about how do people deal with locusts? In most of the world, and in the Ottoman Empire, they're quite limited in terms of what they can do. So, this particular species of locust, they lay eggs pretty shallowly in the ground. So a pretty standard way of responding to them is to collect the eggs or to plow the ground, which often dislodges the eggs. But the problem in the Jazeera is that the population density is so low that it's hard to have enough people to actually do this kind of work. Another thing that's done, and seems like a recurring tradition, is a tradition associated with what's called locust water, sometimes called starling water. And it is the Sufi blessed substance brought from different places at different times. In the late 19th century, it's brought from Konya. This water will be hung from mosques in towns, and it's believed to attract starlings, which then really like eating locusts, and according to some testimonies, they even just like killing them. They don't even eat them. So these are the kind of policies that are possible in the late 19th century. And this is also around the world. This is how it works. You know, the United States has a huge problem with locusts in the late 19th century. They're doing similar things. The governor of Minnesota is calling for a day of fasting to pray for deliverance from the locusts. People try to come up with all these kinds of elaborate ways of killing locusts. They generally don't work. And what eventually wipes out the Rocky Mountain locust is the expansion of cultivation. Mm-hmm. It goes so far that there are no reservoirs for locusts. So at least in the late 19th century, the state of the art is essentially praying and, you know, maybe in some places being able to coerce people into collecting locust eggs. And often this is done in exchange for a bounty, or you have to pay a tax if you don't turn in a certain weight of locust eggs.
So would you say that when the main sort of economic activity in the Jazeera is animal husbandry, locusts are less of a target than when the region is being developed as an agrarian space, as a space for cultivation?
I would cautiously say that, but also we don't know that much about histories of locusts. So I'd be excited if other people were working on this topic to learn more about it. That is my suspicion, that, you know, this basic fact that locusts aren't great for people raising animals either, right? They want to have their grasses to feed their animals, but they also have a different degree of flexibility. They can move their flock of sheep, but they can't move their field of cotton. And so it does seem like the expansion of cultivation in the Jazeera in the late 19th century, which is happening in relation to many internal processes in the Ottoman Empire, Tanzimat reforms, refugees coming from the Russian Empire and the Balkans and needing to settle them. Of course, there are so many pressures wanting to get tax revenues up. That seems to me to be part of the impetus to handle locusts, but as I said, there are real limitations on what people are able to do in the Jazeera to stop the locusts.
So in the late Ottoman period, perhaps what we can say, having read your book, is that the state adopts a certain kind of attitude, not only towards locusts, but also towards people who are inhabitants of the Jazeera. How would you say that their approach changes and is transformed in these sort of final tumultuous decades of the empire?
So I would say there's a general shift from very ambitious efforts to force moving people who raise sheep and camels to settle in the 1860s and the 1870s and to try to keep them in one place. It's a general shift from that to a more pragmatic approach in the 1880s and the 1890s. Perhaps the kind of high watermark of that more ambitious approach is the formation of the district of Zor as a mutasarriflik in 1871. So this is roughly the region around the Syrian city of Deir ez-Zor today, but kind of going across the borders of what's now northeast Syria, southeast Turkey, and northwest Iraq. This special administrative district is the borders are drawn with the idea of enclosing a specific ecology, a desert environment. And there's a real sense that there's a certain kind of people who operate in this desert environment. And if only we can get the borders exactly around the desert, then these, you know, camel raisers who sometimes don't pay their taxes or sometimes raid, you know, a village in one province and then disappear into another province, all these problems will be solved. Of course, all these problems aren't solved. The problem is not the desert. And so this is a point I try to make. The problem isn't simply the desert, but it's also the borders, right? And so borders are seen as a technology to assert control. But in many cases, nomadic pastoralists are really agilely and savvily taking advantage of those same borders and using them to escape a jurisdiction. And so this is a kind of recurring dynamic. The dream of drawing the perfect borders around the desert and the fact that actually figuring out where precisely the desert ends is not simply an ecological fact. It's also a product of how people are moving. So what I see by the 1880s and the 1890s is kind of stepping back from that more assertive high Tanzimat, if we want to call it that, effort. That 1871 construction of Zor even leads to this revolt in which the Shamar attack Baghdad. So this is a real significant event. By the 1890s, we see a shift to relying on Kurdish paramilitary organizations, the Hamidiya light cavalry brigades, the figure Ibrahim Pasha of the Milli tribe. He plays a key role in the book, and he's specifically charged with pushing south into the Jazeera as a way to kind of assert more control over groups like the Shamar. And this is, of course, something different than the, you know, these plans to have wheat growing all through Zor. Maybe that was a little too ambitious, and so we see this shift by the 1890s.
Ibrahim Pasha is an interesting figure, right? Because he is not only sort of charged with managing this area, but also has a sort of complex reputation among various local governors and notables of Kurdish descent, but also is an antagonist to the Shamar. So would you tell us a bit more about him and his activities?
Yeah, he's an interesting guy. So significant is that his base of power is this small town called Viranshahir, which means ruined city. And so there's something kind of poetic about the fact that his power is emerging from this allegedly ruined city. There's even an effort to rename it Yeni Şehir, new city. Right? The name doesn't really take. It's still Viranshahir today. And Viranshahir is almost exactly on the border between Diyarbakir province and Zor. So he's already kind of on the edge in terms of being able to go across borders, you know, sheep that he's taken care of for some people, they can disappear across a border when the tax collector comes, these sorts of things. So he's turning that place on the edge into a kind of power. He's also an ally of Abdul Hamid. He's sending lots of butter from his flocks to the palace. So he's buttered up the officials, if we want to think about it like that. He's made enemies. He's made enemies most notably with large landholders in Diyarbakir. And so on a few occasions, in 1905 and 1907, there are these campaigns of sending telegrams from Diyarbakir complaining of how backward Ibrahim Pasha is. And they say about how he's going to destroy this land. They call him a backward Bedouin, a savage. They compare him to diseases. They say he allegedly has a ring that was owned by Mehmed Ali's son, Ibrahim Pasha, as well. And, you know, that kind of portends separatism. And what's interesting to me about these campaigns is that they're emphasizing him being a backward savage because he's a threat and because he's starting to kind of encroach on their own ability to collect rent on villages in the vicinity of Diyarbakir. Locusts come into this as well. I think it's in 1905 that there's a huge locust outbreak, and so Ibrahim Pasha and the Mili, they bring their flocks close to the city of Diyarbakir to find land to graze on. They're grazing on crops in some cases. And the notables of Diyarbakir, they say, this is disingenuous. He's just using the locusts as an excuse to kind of come closer to us and squeeze us. They say, Çekirge bahanesi. That's what this is. So there's a way, I think there's something interesting about the way that he's presented as so different, as so backward. And it's because of that degree of similarity. So we have these tensions here. And this is, of course, also kind of alongside all of these Ottoman discourses about nomadic pastoralists and how they don't want to work the land and they're lazy and they're not civilized. And actually the problem with Ibrahim Pasha from the view of a lot of Diyarbakir notables is that he is acquiring land. And you know, there are rumors that he's acquiring land around the expected path of the Berlin to Baghdad railway. All kinds of things like this. So he's a very sophisticated operator. He also knows how to pitch himself to an international audience. He wows Mark Sykes, of all people, who I believe describes him as the most interesting man in the Jazeera. So he has a real sense of audience, and I find him quite interesting too.
So to shift gears a little bit, so in the 1900s, there's the story of, you know, Ibrahim Pasha that you just told us. But in about 10 years later, the Jazeera becomes a space for a completely different kind of, maybe it's not so different, that's something you can push back on, state project, right? And this is, of course, the forced deportation of Armenians from various parts of Anatolia into the Jazeera and what would come to be known as the Armenian Genocide. And so how does the Jazeera become the space that they get deported to? Because that doesn't it's not necessarily the space that they would be sent to. And how does the history of the Armenian Genocide interact with the history of the Committee of Union and Progress's more sort of technocratic attempts to manage the locust infestations?
So I see it as a transformation. If we think about the 1860s, there are these attempts to kind of transform the desert. In the 1880s and the 1890s, there are these kind of more pragmatic efforts to project power through people. Maybe don't transform the desert, but be able to project some authority out there. With the genocide and the deportation of many Armenians to Deir ez-Zor, to the Jazeera, not everyone, but many, via Aleppo often, that seems to me a violent use of this landscape as a weapon itself. And of course, Talat Pasha's famous words, they can live in the desert, but nowhere else. Part of the reason why the Jazeera and Zor are the places to which they're sent is because they have such low population densities. Mm-hmm. And so part of, if I don't know if logic is the right word, but part of the justification used for the genocide is the sense that if there is a significant enough of a minority population in certain provinces, they could either revolt, or that could be used by foreign powers as a way to gain power or suggest that there should be some degree of autonomy there. In terms of thinking about it in relation to locusts, as I mentioned before, there are these ways that people are seeing locusts on the way. There's also a case in 1913 where an official calls for a declaration of war against locusts. So there is a kind of convergence there, I would say. There might be declarations of war against locusts before 1913, but there does seem to be a kind of confidence in management of landscape and this horrific management of demography that results in the genocide. And of course, there's a way too that locusts have helped make this environment the harsh landscape that it is. And so this thing that's being used as a weapon, the desert of the Jazeera, this is a thing that is being done by people and that locusts are a part of as well.
One of the people that you talk about in this part of the book, who's certainly caught my attention, is Hovhannes Toros Dumanyan. Can you tell us a bit about this person and how he ends up in the Jazeera and his relationship to the locusts?
Yeah, so Dumanyan is a fascinating figure. And I came across his story because he wrote his memoir over the course of many years. And then his son, Dr. Hrach Dumanyan, translated it from Armenian into English. And Dumanyan was trained as an agronomist at the most advanced agricultural institute in the Ottoman Empire, Halkalı Ziraat Mektebi. And then when his family was deported to Aleppo, by a number of means, he was able to become an assistant for a German official charged with handling locusts. And it seems like he was probably using an assumed name or some fake papers to kind of conceal his identity at this time. But he was nevertheless given a uniform and a lot of arsenic and a team of people working for him. And he was sent to the Jazeera to kill the locusts. And there are particularly bad locusts in these years of World War I. Both in Jazeera and around Izmir in Western Anatolia. And at one point, this is even described as more of a threat to the Ottoman Empire than the rival armies themselves. Perhaps an exaggeration, but nevertheless, there's a real sense of danger. And so Dumanyan is out there killing locusts, doing the work of extermination, and of course at the very same time, this is the landscape in which Armenians are being exterminated as well. So there are a number of cases in his memoir where he describes seeing dead bodies, cases where he is begged for help, and he's actually able to provide that as soon as he's able to get out of earshot of his colleagues who don't know that he's Armenian. He survives. He survives the genocide. And so there's something so striking about the fact that he survives the genocide at the very heart of, the place where so much violence is happening. And he's doing that by exterminating locusts.
Your book sort of ends in the context of French imperialism in the Jazeera after the breakup of the Ottoman Empire, as well as the rise of a sort of nationalist project, both in the Jazeera and in Turkey. How would you say that these sort of projects that look different from the imperialist projects of the previous century interact with locust management, and how do they sort of stake claims on different spaces and policies and of their own legitimacy to rule on the basis of their interaction with the locusts.
So part of what I want to do in the framing of this book, going from the late Ottoman to the post-Ottoman period when the Jazeera becomes divided between the Republic of Turkey, British Mandate of Iraq, French Mandate of Syria, is to show the overlaps. So often the story of empire to nation, if we want to call it that, is presented as a period of flows, lack of borders, to one of borders, restriction. And what I see is, on some level, a continuity. Of course, borders don't mean exactly the same thing after the Ottoman Empire, but for someone who's living on the edge, there are nevertheless many similar dynamics. The Jazeera is divided. Locusts are continuing to fly across all these borders. Officials in different administrations are having arguments that are very reminiscent of lots of Ottoman correspondence I see, where the governor of Aleppo says, I did everything right in my province, and then the lazy governor of Mosul didn't do his work, and that's why the locust came. You see similar versions of this in fights between French, Turkish, and British officials. Questions of, well, were the locusts born in Syria? At one point, the British even suggest that there's a specific species of locust in Iraq that can't possibly leave Iraq, right? So there's a real projection of national categories onto creatures. You asked about legitimacy. There's a way by the 1930s where there's a huge shift that happens in terms of the use of chemical insecticides, mostly arsenic compounds. And this is not just happening in the Jazeera, this is happening all around the world. This is also beginning to happen during World War I. Dumanian was using compounds like this as well. But the British and the French, of course, they don't want to spend that much money on things. And so especially when they first come in, the British are saying, you know, these lazy Ottomans, they didn't do anything. If only they knew something about science, then they would do something. By mid-1920s, they're saying, you know, there's really nothing we can do about these locusts because it costs too much. There's too much space out there. We need to have total control of space to be able to do anything. So on some level, the British and the French aren't really claiming this as a marker of legitimacy. And what I've seen more often, actually, like looking at the Arabic language press from Damascus, Syrians themselves are saying, please do something about these locusts. And, you know, some of it is very funny and sarcastic too, where they say, oh, are you gonna welcome the locusts with Arab hospitality again? You're just going to let them come in and eat whatever they want? And of course, they're saying, no, we don't want that. We want you to kill them because we live in the modern world, allegedly, and we'd like to be free of the depredations of insects. So if anything, I see it emerging among people who are calling for these kinds of interventions. Of course, it's not all people. Plenty of people who actually live in the Jazeera, among them some nomadic pastoralists, they see very clearly that the use of these insecticides also has a profound effect on their flocks, local ecologies, and in some cases their bodies themselves. And so there is some resistance there to the use of these insecticides. But perhaps less than might be expected are the British and French really jumping in and saying, look how great and modern we are. We killed the locusts.
Are there similar petitions in the late Ottoman period by locals to exterminate the locusts, or no?
I mean, there are certainly pleas, but at least as far as I've seen it, there's not that same kind of confidence.
Thank you. Maybe that was a selfish question.
No, not at all.
I was just curious whether there's also this continuity of locals being like, I don't know, there are these animals that we don't want around.
Well, I mean, if I could say very briefly, there is this one case after the Constitutional Revolution of 1908. There's this reform governor in Aleppo, Hussein Kazım. He's an agronomist, and he really doesn't like the large landholders of Aleppo. He writes a newspaper editorial shortly after he comes into office saying he is going to serve the peasants. Shortly after he comes into office, there's this very cold winter. And so it's very hard to do any locust control activities because there's snow on the ground. And so you can't plow, you can't collect eggs or anything like this. And then there's a terrible locust outbreak. The notables who really don't like him because they think he's going to crack down on various problematic things they're doing, they start a campaign to get him removed from office on the basis of his alleged inaction over locusts. And they have a lot of sarcastic sides in their own right. They say things like, the locust doesn't kill itself. You're too busy with journalism. You've really... abdicated responsibility in this case. And they succeed actually in getting him removed from his position. So, that's one kind of a disingenuous invocation of expectations for protection from locusts, but one nevertheless.
That's interesting. Would you say that locusts were seen as pests by your historical actors?
It seems like it. Yeah, certainly. I mean, especially for people who are cultivating, yes. Of course, less so with this particular species do people eat it, but in other places it's very common to eat locusts, and especially further south in the Arabian Peninsula where the locusts are larger, and it's much more common to actually eat the locusts. And so in one case I was reading the memoir of an Ottoman officer who was in Hejaz during World War I, and he's talking about how he needs to build an alliance with some of these local tribes and sheikhs. And he knows the thing he needs to do that is to eat locusts with them. And he's dreading it. He's dreading it. He's dreading it. Finally, he does it. And he says, you know, it's not that bad. It's basically like shrimp. Put some olive oil on it. Put some lemon on it. Fry it. It's great. He didn't say it has high protein, but it does. So,
okay. Yeah. Pests are an interesting sort of category that I was wondering if I'm imposing onto the locusts or if it's a sort of part of their tradition of being in this area, or like part of how locals were seeing it. And I guess it's a sort of relative concept, right? Because it's a pest if it's a nuisance or if it's kind of preventing what people want to do with the space that they're occupying, but not necessarily a pest if it's a delicacy that you get to consume.
Yeah, I mean, the definition of pest is totally dependent on culture, on political economy, what you're trying to produce, what you like to eat.
Right. And what would you say is a sort of, would you say that your book is doing a pest history, or how you, maybe a different way of formulating this question is asking you how you see these kinds of, I'm going to use a word that perhaps you don't like, invasive species are written into animal histories or like histories of the environment.
Yeah, I mean, I think generally in terms of what we have of histories of the somewhat unwieldy term I might use, creatures deemed pests, you know, are pretty aware of the fact that this is a cultural category. It changes depending on what you're trying to produce, what we deem disgusting, right? There are all kinds of questions of why am I terrified of rats, but squirrels are cute, right? But different tales? I don't know. Those are kind of bigger questions. But I think part of what I'm trying to get at is, with these creatures that are sometimes called pests, is they're kind of making use of things that humans have created in a striking way to me. You know, this happens, this is a huge theme in environmental history, of course. You know, how do we draw the line between nature and culture? I mean, not just environmental history, much, much broader than that. And I think there's something particular about locusts, about rats, where they're really blurring these boundaries. And so that seems interesting and productive to me, and also ensures that people are constantly talking about them, right? But, you know, as I said at the beginning, you can certainly read a lot of scientific articles about locust entomology, but also you can just read consular reports or various bureaucratic correspondence where they're talking about what the peasants are complaining about. And so I think I think this is a somewhat conservative view of animal history, actually, is that people are talking about animals and therefore we as historians should figure out what they're talking about.
People are talking about animals, so we as historians should figure out what they're talking about. I like that. Because for me, I mean, in terms of thinking about animal history, which is not my sort of particular approach at this point in time, we are constantly interacting with them through the mediation of human words. I mean, maybe not, you know, more recent histories, it could be by video or by photographs, but for many of us, text is the main source of understanding where animals stood in this history. How do we break out of a human-centered approach to animals when these are the sources that we are made to deal with as historians?
Well, I think part of the reason I don't have a good answer to that very good question is because of this somewhat conservative approach I mentioned just now. And it's not, you know, this is not my idea. Erica Fudge, among many other people, have made this point. And I think especially in relation to, perhaps especially in relation to the history of the Middle East, where environmental history as a self-defined field is still somewhat new, of course, not entirely distinct from older concerns of political economy and agrarian empires, but as a self-defined field, you know, 15 years old or so. Is that I'm still at this point where I'm interested in what people say about these creatures. And I think as I was thinking about this project, as I was presenting on it for many years, I got so many suggestions that this should be called Can the Locust Speak, right? in homage to Tim Mitchell's famous work, Can the Mosquito Speak, which really helped me think through and envision a lot of things and really blew my mind the first time I read it. And I think part of what I'm trying to say here is, yeah, certainly locusts have a real material impact on the world. They cause, they eat all kinds of crops, which then can lead to famines depending on how states respond to them. They terrify people. They lead to migration. But also people are constantly talking about them, and people are constantly projecting human categories onto them as well. And so I think I'm committed to that kind of entanglement, if we want to call it that, on some level. And also if we're to think about, you know, what's going on with locusts on their own a little more, you know, the fact that they live in this region of the Jazeera, if we think about them kind of leading us to think about space in a different way, that's one way. Another aspect of their behavior that I found really interesting is that they tend to mate and lay eggs on these small hills that are all across the Jazeera called Tub. And these aren't naturally occurring geological formations, but rather accumulated dirt on ancient ruins. And so in the late 19th century, Ottoman officials, European travelers, they see these hills and they say, how did this become a wasteland? Surely it was these nomads who have just destroyed everything with their sheep and camels. But we have evidence here, because look at all these ruins and look at all these small hills that contain ruins. This is also a time of archaeology in new ways. We can do this again. We can turn it into something else. And the fact that on those very same hills, locusts are mating and laying eggs, that struck me as a powerful image of this entanglement, but not necessarily entanglement in the sense of kind of projection of human categories onto locus, but of locus quite literally using this ancient human infrastructure to thwart these visions of, you know, a new granary in the Jazeera. So that would be a kind of more material direction that one could go to.
We've seen how various human communities in the Jazeera are compared to locusts, as well as how things that locusts have done are attributed to various human communities that are that have gained a sort of reputation or who are painted as being sort of destroyers or what have you. And that's interesting because perhaps the goal in this sort of nascent field of environmental history and animal history is not to sort of write the humans out of it, but rather to see, if I'm understanding also your work, but also what you've been saying correctly, it is to think of the ways in which the social world is constructed in relation to nature and how nature is constructed in relation to social world. So these are in a sort of like in a constant relationship with each other.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm not interested in leaving humans behind at all. And you said it better than I could.
And so in this vein, I want to ask you about social history. because I do think that the human stories you tell in the book are really powerful. And also, one of the sort of great joys of doing social history, even though sometimes you're like dealing with the daily occurrence of horrible tragedies to people, is the fact that you're writing about ordinary folk who've been living in different parts of the world. And you really get to sort of take part in their everyday experiences of the places they lived, times late they lived. And they also have descendants that you can find and talk to. And I'm wondering if you've had such an experience that ended up coming to light in the aftermath of writing the book.
First, what I would say is, of course, the social is important to me. And I think to go back to a part of the very beginning of the conversation, I hope this is the case for readers. It was certainly the case for me. But as I wrote, just seeing the accumulation of stories in the same place, the same kinds of things happening in the same place, decade after decade after decade, that was something that was... I don't know if surprising is the right word, but there was a layering effect that I hope to be able to create in the book. And so I think part of what I'm responding to in terms of the genocide and scholarship on the genocide is that with the pressure of having to prove that this event happened, there is a tendency for very understandable reasons to follow the deportations and then stop. And so part of what I hope to do in the book is linger in this space before and after and mm-hmm. see the kinds of echoes that occur across mm-hmm. time and see how this event, which is in so many ways exceptional, is also profoundly connected to regional history. And, you know, there's a way that you can read histories of Syria in the 1920s, and it's strangely as if the Armenian genocide did not happen in this space. And I don't have anyone in mind in particular when I say this. And I think it is, you know, a product of division of scholarly labor. That's an Ottoman thing. I'm doing a post-Ottoman thing. The fact that the Jazeera is out there, it's far away. The fact that Syrian history is still kind of seen as Arab history, a thing that's done with Arabic language sources and not Armenian sources. Of course, that's changing, but that's one thing that I'm thinking about. And as you said, there are plenty of people who are descendants of people who have had these experiences who can talk about that. And so I had the incredible good fortune to meet Johannes Torres Dumanian's son, Dr. Hrach Dumanian, in California last fall. And it was such an honor to speak with him and to learn from him. And to be able to ask some questions that seemed kind of left out of the memoir, or just to ask him how it felt to translate this text, what it was like to talk to his dad. I mean, the other thing that happened a fair amount as I was doing this project was I just struggled to describe the space I was talking about, and people wouldn't know in many cases what the Jazeera was. Thought maybe I'm talking about the Arabian Peninsula, Al Jazeera Al Arabiya, or the city of Jizre. But then in many cases, or I shouldn't say many, but in a few cases, people immediately knew, and it was often because they had some kind of connection to the place. And so there's a way that it's a biography of no place, to use Kate Brown's words, but also a way that it's not forgotten by people whose paths have gone through there in some way.
To close our conversation, right? I think we've now been speaking for some time. I wanted to ask you how you feel about locusts after writing about them for such a long time.
In what sense?
In all the senses.
Well, you know, I guess I'd be very excited if people wanted to take up any of these questions. I will probably not be writing about locusts in the short term. I don't think. I'm happy to think about other things, and like I said, happy to see if other people have new projects about them or critiques of what I've done. You know, very, very happy to see that. But I think, yeah, my concerns remain questions of how environment and people come together to make place. I think that's the thing, maybe the through line between locus of power and things I've been thinking about recently, which is more about trees and plants and people going other places, and maybe those trees and plants staying, or maybe those trees and plants going those other places. I think it's place.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Sam, for joining me in Istanbul to have this conversation. And I look forward to reading your work in the future and to continue being in conversation.
Thank you, Darren. Thank you so much for your good questions and for thinking with my work.